From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is a quiet day in Washington today after a big day yesterday, a day of celebration for President Trump when House Republicans finally passed their bill to repeal and replace much of the law known as Obamacare.
You know, coming from a different world and only being a politician for a short period of time, how am I doing? Am I doing okay? I'm president. Hey, I'm president. Can you believe it, right?
And on the House floor, as the GOP bill passed, Democrats taunted Republicans in song, convinced they'll lose elections because of the bill.
Joining us for our weekly politics roundtable, Jesse Holland of the Associated Press. Hi, Jesse.
How you doing?
And it's always good to hear the music of steam, you know, 40 years later. Domenico Montanaro, politics editor for NPR, is here as well. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, I had no idea who actually sang that song.
Steam, 1969, one of my favorites, but anyway.
Oh, yeah. I remember 1969.
Domenico, you're one of many pointing out that this bill from the House still has to go to the Senate. But we have President Trump declaring victory in that unusual Rose Garden celebration yesterday. Unusual, because it's not yet a bill. Here he is.
Make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it. Make no mistake. And I think most importantly, yes, premiums will be coming down. Yes, deductibles will be coming down. But very importantly, it's a great plan.
So, Domenico, start there. Isn't this a triumph for Donald Trump?
Well, you know, it's a relief for him that he could get something through the House finally, but it's hardly a triumph. I mean, this is the low bar of, you know, considering that Republicans control the House. This is majority plus one. It should be the easy thing to do. So hardly a triumph. It is an incremental win. That's an important thing. But this bill has zero chance of becoming law and is a bizarre moment for them to be celebrating the way they were in the Rose Garden, which really tells you just how, you know, how difficult this was to get through and how relieved they are to be able to go home for recess and have something at least that they passed through and now can pass the buck to the Senate.
This bill has zero chance of becoming law, but Jesse, it does make it seem a little more plausible that they'll get something through the Senate and then, you know, they have a bigger chance of passing a repeal and replace of Obamacare now.
Well, I mean, I don't know if this bill gives them a greater chance to get anything through the Senate. Mm-hmm. The Republicans in the Senate have already said that they're not even going to start with the House bill. They're going to write their own. They may let a little of what the House has done inform them, but they're not even going to consider this bill. There's no chance of this bill, as passed by the House, passing the Senate. What we're going to see happen is the Senate come up with its own bill and then look back at the House and say, this is what you're going to have to agree to. So All the House did is the same thing it did during the last years of President Obama. It passed another bill dealing with Obamacare that isn't going to go anywhere.
Well, let's talk about one of the reasons people suspect that. And Domenico, I want you to take this. It has to do with these state waivers that are in this House bill. It essentially amounts to what is the real repeal of Obamacare. It would give states the ability to apply for a waiver that would opt them out of some of the regulations that are existing under the Affordable Care Act. So a state can do three things. They can charge older people more than five times what they charge younger people. You can't do that under Obamacare. They can eliminate required coverage called essential health benefits. This includes maternity care, mental health coverage. This was also required under the Affordable Care Act. And they can charge more for or deny coverage to people who have pre-existing health conditions. This could include cancer, diabetes, arthritis. This is according to the NPR analysis. Domenico, this seems to be where some people have, including Senate Republicans, have the most nervousness.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things in this bill that are just, you know, they're difficult for Republicans to defend. I mean, all of those things that you listed are reasons why the bill, the first version of it, had just a 17% approval rating, according to one Quinnipiac poll. People don't want to see health benefits mandates taken out of this bill and have the bill cost more. Now, Republicans are arguing that if you take these older, sicker folks and put them in high-risk pools in states, that that can bring down the cost for healthier people. But the whole point of Obamacare was to be able to reduce the cost across the board. And if you have pre-existing conditions, that you can be covered and it won't bankrupt you. This seems to be going backward in a different direction. You know, of course, the healthcare can be very expensive. We already have high-risk pools in this country in the form of Medicare. But remember, Medicare was set up because elderly folks couldn't get covered. So they were being discriminated against and not allowed to sign up. But Medicare is something that blows a giant hole in the budget. Mm. That was the point of Obamacare. Don't make the same kind of mistake as Medicare, where you create a system where it's not really subsidized by healthier, younger people. The big problem with Obamacare was they couldn't get enough healthy, younger people to sign up for it.
Yeah.
So what about the politics of this? And Jesse, let me go back to you.
Right.
The House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said Republicans who voted for the bill would glow in the dark because it's so radioactive. Can they take back – can the Democrats take back the House on this vote?
Well, the Democrats certainly think they can. One of the things that has shifted because of President Trump is that in past years, the House Republicans could vote on repealing Obamacare and not have to worry about the consequences, because in addition to it not making it through the Senate, they knew President Obama would veto it. Now, all of a sudden, they have to pass a bill that could possibly become law.
Right.
And now they have to go back and defend it to their people. Even the American public knew in the past that whatever the House Republicans did on Obamacare would not ever become law. Now they actually have to legislate in such a way where they have to defend it. Democrats think this vote on this bill will be hard for Republicans to defend next year, and they plan to keep continually slamming them with this vote.
Does it make a difference? Does it make a difference for the people on the Republican side who voted against it? Or are they going to be lumped in?
Well, I don't know if it would make a difference for them. They're going to be tagged with being a Trump Republican who voted and whose party voted
right
in the House to get rid of Obamacare without coming up with a solution for it. If I was a Democrat, I would be banging it against their head. If you're a Republican, being able to say, well, you know, I didn't vote for this, but my party did, I don't know if that's much of a shield.
Okay, so we don't know if the Republicans are, you know, if this is their mission accomplished, thinking of George W. Bush, or if, you know, this is actually going to, in other words, it's not really accomplished, or if it is. But let's move on to other things that happened during the week, because there were other things this week, and there was a temporary budget bill that was passed. And the budget director, Mike Mulvaney, accused the Democrats of, you know, maybe spiking the ball, celebrating too early, because he said that the Democrats say they got a lot of what they wanted and the president didn't get the money he wanted for the Pentagon or the wall with Mexico. But Mulvaney says this.
The president delivered on his promises and got his priorities funded, and that's what the Democrats don't want you to know. They want you to think they won. What they don't want you to know is the American people won here, because the president simply out-negotiated them.
Again, Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. I think I said Mike. Domenico, a little too much protesting there. He was standing in front of a picture of the wall. What was going on there?
Well, what started was Donald Trump with a tweet at 9:01 in the morning, you know, blasting Democrats about the fact that he had gotten through his, that he'd gotten a win. Something triggered him that morning. And once that happens, then everybody in the West Wing, you know, winds up echoing what the president is doing. You had Mick Mulvaney go in thunder before the reporters there with photos of border fencing that he said falsely that this funding bill would be a down payment on the wall. And look, these are pictures of the wall that's being built. I mean, the president did not get through a lion's share of his priorities. What he did get through was a military funding increase. It was half of what he wanted, but it was a military funding increase. They got some more money for border security and fence mending, but he did not get money for a border wall. Okay, they got $1 billion or so in ability to make fixes and increase technology, but a border wall would cost upwards of $20 billion with a B, if that might be conservative. So, no, this was PR and spin. The president is all about optics and winning. Those are the that's what he really cares about. And the media narrative throughout the day was that President Trump took a loss and Democrats took a win, when in reality, this was a compromise bill between both parties. Democrats didn't get everything they wanted. Republicans didn't get everything they wanted. They all got something that they wanted. Nobody walked away perfectly happy, but some people are able to then come away and say that they took a measure of victory, and President Trump didn't like that you had Democrats going out saying that Trump took a loss.
Well, having just gotten back from Mexico City, where we did the show last week, I will tell you that even though President Trump didn't get the money for his wall in that bill, that every time he talks about it, the peso drops and the Mexicans say, stop talking and tweeting about the wall. It is not helpful.
I thought
to
you
us.
Were going to say every time he talked about it in bars in Mexico City, people took a shot.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
That's a good game right there.
Well, that's the time we have this week. But Domenico Montanaro, politics editor for NPR, and Jesse Holland, a reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
On to next week.
Hey, goodbye.
Steam, check it out. It's here and now. Fox News is facing a new lawsuit from radio reporter Jessica Gallagher, who says she was fired after complaining about sexual discrimination. Fox calls her claims baseless. But this week also saw the resignation of Fox News president Bill Shine, who's accused of ignoring harassment complaints about chair Roger Ailes and host Bill O'Reilly, who've both been forced out, along with former Fox comptroller Judith Slater, who's being accused with other managers in a class action lawsuit filed last week of racial discrimination and harassment at Fox. Kelly Wright is part of that lawsuit, the only male African-American anchor on Fox News. He moved from the popular Fox and Friends show to overnight anchor. Kelly, welcome to you.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Douglas Wigdor, Kelly's lawyer. Doug, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having us, Robin.
And Doug, I know you are going to be speaking to some of the allegations made by other Fox employees in this lawsuit. Kelly, what is your complaint?
Well, it's one of marginalization and institutional racism, and this kind of bias covers a lot of African-American male talent throughout the country, wherein we're not able to go out and step out and have the same opportunities that some of our white colleagues have in order to grow with the company and get in more prominent roles. In my situation, the prominent role that I once had was taken away towards the end of 2007, beginning of 2008, and that's when I was the co-anchor of Fox and Friends Weekend. And I remember a lot of people asking me, what happened? And I said, to be honest with you, I don't know. I was just told by Bill Shine that we're, you know, CNN is catching up with us. We're going to change the team. And at the time, I didn't know where to go in terms of protesting it. I just said, well, look, it's not my toy store. I have no control over these decisions that are being made, but I will continue to strive to give 1,000% and do my best. And they replaced me with a white colleague of mine, or actually they hired a new guy in. And so Fox and Friends Weekend at that time had gone all white.
Well, you know, this gets awfully messy, awfully
it
fast
does.
When it comes to
it
this
does.
Because, you know, we are all in broadcasting, and as we know, it can be very subjective. So Fox News can say, for instance, it has nothing to do with color, it's about ratings. Did you start to put your finger on things that people said or, you know, things that you picked up that make it more than that kind of, you know, don't take this personally, it's about ratings?
Robin, this is Doug Wigdor speaking, and I think that's a great question. But what we have here at the very highest level, where you have 37 board and executive team members, you only have one black person. And so how could you say in 2017 that there's only one qualified black person to sit on the board and the executive team? That's just impossible. You then have a general counsel who turns a blind eye since 2008 of the racist behavior of Judith Slater, who's the comptroller of Fox News. And we're talking about some of the most racist comments that this woman was making to our clients, including things like questioning whether one of our clients who had three children had the same father, raising her hands and mocking the Black Lives Movement by saying, hands up, don't shoot.
To black colleagues at Fox.
Yeah, to her people actually who reported to her. She would threaten them. She would ask them to repeat words such as mother, father. She would ask why black men were only woman beaters. And so people complained to her as early as 2008. And as I said, the general counsel, the top lawyer at Fox News said, look, there's nothing I can do because this woman knows too much. So when you have the chief lawyer turning a blind eye to racism, when you have the comptroller engaging in open racist conduct, the question really isn't whether Kelly Wright or any other black male or female is being viewed subjectively. It's obvious that there is systemic racism going on.
Well, as we know, Fox News says they vehemently deny these claims. They say in a statement these are copycat complaints from the sexual harassment complaint. We will vigorously defend these cases. But Kelly, you've spoken about comments that now come to mind to you. For instance, something someone said to you about your hair.
There were several times, not just from one colleague, but other colleagues have said, gee, if you would change your hair blonde, you might have a better role to play here, because many people thought, well, why is Kelly on an overnight shift? And actually, I accepted that with the understanding that perhaps it would lead to doing more. But the inside joke was, gee, if Kelly had a different color, mm-hmm. he might rise to all the highest ranks available to him. And, you know, those things are – they hurt, actually, because you – especially when I was saying to management, to leaders there, we are viewed as being too white. Can we at least look at the possibilities? And quite frankly, when I was raising my hand saying, put me in the game, put me in the mix. I don't care what you do, just put me out there on some of your primetime shows, on some of your main shows. And I want to make this very clear, Robin, it's not about me. It was really about trying to show and be reflective of what the country is. Hmm. We're not all white.
Well, Kelly Wright, though, isn't it true that when you asked Bill O'Reilly if you could come on the show to talk about racial conciliation, especially with all the news headlines that we've had, Bill suggested that you call Mr. Ailes and Bill Shine, and this is the New York Times reporting, and offer to sing the national anthem at the Fox News town halls. I mean, was that his reaction to you?
That happened in a sequence of things, and
yeah.
I remember going to him on the heels of Ferguson, and I said, look, as long as you're talking about Ferguson, as long as you're talking about what's the ills of the black community, would you please consider having me on as a guest to talk about what's right about this community, and perhaps you could show a little bit of my series Beyond the Dream? Mm-hmm. He said, what is it? And I said, well, basically, I go into communities like a black community where, and I don't overlook the negatives, but I show how people are proactively involved in changing the community by mentoring, by helping people understand that they have the ability to pursue their American dream, and there are ways to do it without being a thug or a gangster. And the response was, it's too positive. And I was actually kind of taken aback by that. And then at a later time, Bill had always liked the fact that I was a singer. And he said, well, gee, you know, why don't you consider asking Bill Shine and Roger Ailes, and don't tell them I told you this, but why don't you consider asking them to do the national anthem or some patriotic song at some of these Fox Hall town hall events or before some of the debates? And I thought, well, that's odd. I really wanted to come to you on a professional level as a two-time Emmy Award-winning journalist to talk about a serious problem. And I don't mind singing, but that's not how I want to perceive when I came to you with something that I think could have benefited America other than me singing a nice song.
Well, why not use the word minstrel? I mean, you know, there's an echo there. I'm sure other people are hearing. Look, Kelly Wright, we also are reading reports of Ms. Slater, the comptroller, asking that minority employees arm wrestle the white female supervisors for her entertainment. Maybe she was kidding, but not funny.
Not funny at all.
That she mocked how black employees pronounced words like ask. If this was allegedly the culture, why did you stay there? Chris Wallace is a pretty respected journalist. He hosts the Fox Sunday news program. Fox and Friends often has a very dismissive tone about stories about blacks in our culture. And if this was the culture inside that building, why'd you stay?
That's a very good question. When I was with Fox and Friends, they didn't have that dismissive attitude because I was on the air to knock that down, mm-hmm. and in a very professional and courteous kind of way. After Fox and Friends, I kept working on the inside, thinking that I could change the system and the culture from within. And I would get frustrated. I remember going home so many times, and I remember my family saying, why do they take you so far, and then mm-hmm. it's almost as if they pull the rug out from under you, and how long will you put up with this? And I guess I was guilty of, like any other person in that particular situation. I'm an African-American male. I'm putting two kids through college. So I kept my head low, kept doing the work. And there are other people who go through the same thing, not just at Fox, but across the country. We're on-air talent. We realized if we go for it, it's a very dangerous place to go because you've run the risk of retaliation. But I stayed there because I was talking to them. And I was believing them that they, in fact, wanted to do something to change the culture until I saw what happened in the other department. And then I began to really look at me and say, how long will I remain silent? And I came forward and with hurt because it hurts. It's painful. These are people that I know. These are people that I expressed my intentions to, my best of intentions. And again, I have to stress, this is not about me. This is not about playing anybody's race card or being a crybaby. This is about righting the ship because I believe that Fox News still has better days ahead. But it has to change because we are better than this. And it's not about us against them. It's not just about Fox News. It is about America.
That's Fox News anchor Kelly Wright. He has now signed on to a class action suit alleging that, well, in effect, he was effectively sidelined and asked to perform the role of a Jim Crow, the racist caricature of a black entertainer at Fox News. Douglas Wigdor is the lawyer who's representing Kelly and others in the suit. Doug, Kelly, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
A report out this week shows that of the 140,000 pedestrians questioned by police in Philadelphia last year, a quarter was stopped illegally. For the past 6 years, a court-appointed monitor has been overseeing reforms to the city's police department after the ACLU of Pennsylvania found widespread abuse in the way officers interact with civilians. As Bobby Allen of Here and Now contributor WHYY reports, this new report shows that the department has been willing to change its practices, but improper stops continue.
Growing up in a predominantly black part of North Philly, Landon Rouse says he was often randomly stopped by police.
I mean, if you were in a group of people that you look like you maybe doing something, they stop you. They run up on you a lot.
What did he feel like the stops were based on?
Ethnicity, the area you in. So it happens.
Philadelphia police are being retrained and supervisors are holding patrol officers more accountable in an effort to end the kind of stop-and-frisk encounters that Rouse describes. And the new report shows those changes have paid off. The total number of stops are down, and more often, cops question people only after suspecting a crime could be afoot, which is required under federal law. But even though the total number of stops are down, critics say there's still too many of them. 35,000 pedestrians were stopped seemingly at random last year. David Rudofsky, who sued the police department over this, says that's illegal.
We see a fair amount of kind of generic terms being used, whether it's loitering or miscreant or standing on the corner or being in an alley, which simply doesn't translate into criminal activity.
Rudofsky says even when police had legal justification for stopping someone, the vast majority of pedestrians stopped were innocent. But if officers just did something simple, apologize, he says that might go a long way in restoring trust in police in many neighborhoods.
But when the officer walks away, as we've seen historically in Philadelphia, doesn't give an explanation, or worse, when the person says, why we stopped, and the officer says, you keep running your mouth, I'm going to run you in, that's what degrades police-community relations.
Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross says the department gets calls every day from residents about suspicious activity in their neighborhoods. Investigating those situations is a basic part of police work. Ross says the number of crimes averted by pedestrian stops is hard to quantify, but he says they keep the city safer.
There are a lot of guns on our streets, and 1,200 people were shot last year. And there are issues this year, guns are unfortunately an integral part of what we deal with each and every day.
Still, critics say out of more than 100,000 stops in 2016, cops found guns less than 1% of the time. The renewed focus on stop and frisk comes just as voters in Philadelphia prepare to go to the polls later this month to choose a new district attorney. It's a fiercely contested seven-way race where many of the candidates are promising progressive reforms to the city's criminal justice system. But as Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney said at City Hall earlier this week, on stop and frisk, change is slow. It requires undoing a deeply entrenched police tactic.
It's not like turning off a switch. You can't come in on day one and turn off a switch and stop it automatically. This took a lot of work and a lot of thinking and a lot of training and a lot of process in order for us to get where we are, and we're not close to being done yet.
Civil rights attorneys say since nearly 70% of all the thousands of stops made last year were to black pedestrians, some of those interactions may have been driven by bias. And city leaders, police supervisors, and a court order have promised to change that. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Philadelphia.
Historic rainfall and flooding are overwhelming parts of the Midwest. In Arkansas, Governor Asa Hutchinson deployed the National Guard after 9 levees were breached, causing significant damage. Mike Ellis, a farmer on the Black River, saw his farm flooded.
We have over $100,000 worth of stuff with water either in it or around it.
Hundreds had to be evacuated, including Amanda Looney of Pocahontas, Arkansas. I spoke with her this morning and asked her to tell me about the evacuation.
Oh, I was actually at work when they announced it. Me and my husband left. We had to go home and get, we have 4 cats and 2 dogs. We had to go home and get them back across the bridge. And it was kind of chaos and panic. Just there was a lot of rumors going around saying that they were going to break our levees, and that would have caused, you know, flash flooding and stuff like that. And it was just, it was panic, the best way to describe it.
How close was the water to your house at that point?
Actually, it wasn't, it was coming up in the farmland around us, but it wasn't, like the roads weren't impeded or anything at that point. It was north of us, but they knew it was coming. And in 2011, we had a flood that, I mean, it came fast, and they weren't as prepared then. Like, the evacuation notices didn't come as quick. And this time, everybody knew better. You know, once they start saying evacuate, you evacuate.
So where are you staying now?
I'm staying with my mom. She's over in the other side of Pocahontas, and it's dry over there.
Have you been able to go back to your house yet?
No, we haven't. We tried to go over there yesterday, and they told us they weren't letting residents in. The water's still pretty high on the roads getting into the addition that we live in.
Give us a sense of what it's like there right now. You're going to work today. Is life going on as normal, or are people having to make adjustments?
People are definitely having to make adjustments. There's still quite a bit of water on the roads here in town, and people are working with it, but it's been, honestly, for people who've been displaced, our community has really come together. We've had people donating all kinds of stuff. I've gotten messages that, you know, we've got this furniture you can have. We've got clothes if you need a place to stay, if you need food. We have all kinds of drives going on for these people, you know, and there are people who are a lot worse off than me.
What kind of damage are they facing?
There are some houses that got water probably 6 inches from the roof. And there was a 7-foot privacy fence along part of our addition, and it was almost completely covered.
So as far as you know, though, how is your house?
As far as I know, my house should be okay. The water may have gotten up underneath it. It's a little bit raised off the ground. It kind of goes up the slope. It seems like the water may have gotten up underneath it, but probably not in it. But we won't know for sure till we can get in there.
All right. Well, best of luck to you, Amanda. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Amanda Looney in Pocahontas, Arkansas. And Arkansas is not alone. Flooding impacted more than 100 highways in the St. Louis region. And elsewhere in the U.S., there's a streak of extreme weather from deadly tornadoes to spring blizzards. Let's bring in Brett Anderson, senior meteorologist for AccuWeather. And Brett, let's start with the flooding in the Midwest. What's going on there and what's the latest?
Yeah, we've had a series of storm systems moving through the region there, and what's been going on is the Gulf of Mexico has been unusually warm this spring. So with a warmer Gulf of Mexico, that's supplying additional moisture into these storms that are coming in off the Rockies. The other problem we also have is high pressure off the East Coast acting as a block. So these storms are moving easter and slowing down. So we're getting round after round of very heavy rainfall across the same region over the past week, and the result result, obviously, has been significant flooding.
Is the worst yet to come, or is the worst of it over?
The worst is definitely over. Major pattern change actually undergoing as we get into this weekend. High pressure will be building in across the nation's midsection. So good news there. We're going to see a significant drying and may not see a drop of rain, actually, this weekend into at least Monday across those areas.
What about the severe weather that we're seeing right now? People in Atlanta reported a possible tornado. Mm-hmm. We do know that the area has seen heavy winds, but also in Texas, residents were hit with deadly tornadoes. What's going on with all of that?
Well, a lot of it's springtime. Tornado is not all that uncommon this time of year across Texas all the way into Georgia. So, again, nothing that terribly unusual. And once again, I'll go back to the Gulf of Mexico. Very warm, so that's supplying added humidity to the air. In order to get tornadoes, you need a few ingredients. You need high humidity. You also need some fairly strong storms, a storm system moving up from the west to meet up with that humidity. So we're seeing a lot of that over the past couple of weeks here, and the result has been an increase in tornadic activity, especially across the southern states.
We also saw a blizzard in the plains. Now, yeah. I can remember blizzards on May 1st. We're getting into May here, but it's still kind of unusual. It certainly feels too late for snow.
Yeah, it's not unusual in the Front Range of the Rockies and Denver and places like that.
Right.
But yeah, as you get farther east into the places such as Kansas, Nebraska, and those areas, lower elevation, it gets a little bit unusual as you get into early May to see wind and significant snowfall in those areas.
Any indications about what kind of summer this is going to be?
Yeah, I think we're looking at overall a very warm to hot summer across much of the nation, especially across the western half of the nation. I think in the east, it's still going to be warmer than normal, but we'll have opportunities for showers and thunderstorms, which should keep rainfall fairly close to normal.
That's Brett Anderson, senior meteorologist with AccuWeather. Brett, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, being a caregiver is rewarding on many levels, but studies show that providing such a high level of care for someone with dementia can make you less healthy physically and mentally. And if caregivers are stressed, research shows the people they care for are more likely to end up in the hospital or in a nursing home. Anna Gorman from Kaiser Health News takes us to a workshop in Los Angeles designed to help caregivers cope.
Gary Carmona thought he could do it all. He's run companies and chaired nonprofit boards. But when his wife was diagnosed with dementia, 77-year-old Carmona was quickly overwhelmed.
And I really see myself at times crashing. I'm saying, you know, I can't really handle all this.
There was the time his wife, Rochelle, wandered outside and fell down, and the time when she boiled water and forgot to turn off the burner.
So I'm always double and triple and quadruple checking everything that she's around.
Carmona is at a Los Angeles area senior center to learn how to be a better caregiver. He's one of about two dozen people attending sessions on how to make their home safe, keep their relatives calm, and manage their own stress. Dr. Zaldi Tan of UCLA created what he calls a caregiver boot camp.
We are helping them to be the best caregiver that they can be now and preparing them for what will come in the future.
Tan says that means understanding the progression of the disease. He tells the group that people with early stage dementia may just seem confused, but over time they need help with daily tasks like getting dressed. Finally, they become completely dependent.
Unfortunately, this is also the time that they might not remember your relationship with them, and I know it's heartbreaking.
Pam Meyer, who's 60, says her husband still remembers who she is, but he does forget basic things, like what day it is. He also gets agitated and says mean things to her.
It's stressful and it's maddening.
Meyer says she came to the boot camp because she wants some tips on how to better handle his disease.
Us as caregivers, we're part of the problem because we get angry. We get emotional.
Tan says people with dementia get emotional, too. In just an instant, they can shift from relaxed to agitated, happy to angry. That's usually because of triggers.
A trigger is just like a trigger in the gun, right? You push something and then you get a reaction.
Avoiding those triggers can help keep people with dementia calm. So can playing games or listening to music. Patty Anderson is a recreational therapist. She demonstrates one game for caregivers to try at home, Music Bingo.
What's the name of this song, guys? Bye-bye, Blackbird. Okay, so if you have that one, mark it off.
Anderson says that even with memory loss, people with dementia may still recognize songs.
But even if they're confused, they can clap, make it fun, dance.
As the group breaks for lunch, several caregivers say they plan to try some of the games and new strategies at home. Meyer says the boot camp was valuable to her for another reason.
Just knowing that there are other people out there going through the same things as I am is helpful.
UCLA started the boot camps in 2015 and hopes to expand elsewhere around the state in the coming year. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Gorman in Los Angeles.
Late Night TV made some headlines this week. Did Stephen Colbert cross a line in his searing monologue about President Trump that landed on a vulgar joke?
Mr. Trump, your presidency, I love your presidency. I call it disgrace the nation. You're not the POTUS, you're the BLOTUS. You're the glutton with the button. You're a regular gorge Washington. You're the presidents, but you're turning into a real tater. Sir, you attract more skinheads than free Rogaine. You have more people marching against you than cancer. You talk like a sign language gorilla who got hit in the head. In fact, the only thing your mouth is good for is being Vladimir Putin's holster.
That last line launched the hashtag Fire Colbert and calls to boycott the show. He came back the next day to say he'd only apologize for that bleeped word. Then there was Jimmy Kimmel, tearfully talking about his son just born with congenital heart disease. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. David, your thoughts on this week that was?
Well, I guess among other things, the two episodes disabuse us of the notion that the late night hosts are no longer relevant. They're out of the conversation. They happen to have some audiences, but they've really been superseded. In this case, Stephen Colbert was rising to what he saw as President Trump's dismissive attitude toward fairly reasonable and civilly but insistent questions from his CBS colleague John Dickerson in the Oval Office about characterizations that Trump had made of President Obama, among other things. And at a certain point, Trump essentially said, we're done here. You can go. And Colbert basically said, well, John Dickerson's too much of a gentleman. Let me come back. Now, what you just played was pungent. It was raunchy and raw. If you say that there is a line in late night comedy, it may have strayed on the other side of it. And I understand why people can take offense. On the other hand, I've got offense sensitivity fatigue. You know, people are finding it useful to take offense, in addition to some people being genuinely offended by what's being said.
Well, and he, as we said, he did come back and say he had no regrets about the entire presentation. He would perhaps trade out that one last pretty vulgar reference, which some people, by the way, thought is homophobic.
Well, they did, because it suggested that Donald Trump was performing a sexual act upon Vladimir Putin. That's a pretty raw thing to suggest. It's hardly unheard of in comedy to suggest that. And we have fewer women world leaders than we do men. So it's more likely than not to involve two men. And at the same time, you know, some have suggested it was homophobic. I think what Colbert was trying to do was suggest that Trump was subservient to someone else, not to suggest that there's something wrong with gay sex. You know, Stephen Colbert's performance was intentionally over the top. He was trying in each one of those cascading insults to top what it was he had just said, what it was that just had come out of his mouth. It was almost as though the form of the insult and the rising level of each additional insult was the joke, in addition to whatever joke he was telling.
Well, then there was Jimmy Kimmel, who gave that emotional monologue, 15, 60 minutes long. His newborn son had just come into the world with this frightening congenital heart condition, had to have emergency heart surgery almost immediately after birth. Kimmel told his whole story, teared up several times, and ended with this.
Until a few years ago, millions and millions of us had no access to health insurance at all. You know, before 2014, if you were born with congenital heart disease like my son was, there was a good chance you'd never be able to get health insurance because you had a pre-existing condition. You were born with a pre-existing condition. If your parents didn't have medical insurance, you might not live long enough to even get denied because of a pre-existing condition. If your baby is going to die, and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. I think that's something that, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or something else, we all agree on that, right? I mean, we do.
We get a lot of applause there. But there were people who said that he was being too partisan, as House Republicans were getting ready to pass their plan, which changes how we approach pre-existing conditions. Some people say it will deny people coverage who have pre-existing conditions. And by the way, we should say that House Republicans would say that while their plan allows states to allow insurance companies not to cover people with pre-existing conditions, they say they will have these pools, these high-risk pools that will help them out. But, you know, that debate goes on.
Sure. But Robin, I think the important thing is he wasn't really getting into the weeds of specific clauses in the policy. He was talking about the question of what he sees as sort of certain transcendent American values. And, you know, just as David Letterman would sometimes walk in and say things from the heart after 9/11, after certain moments of crises, after certain things that happened to him personally, his heart surgery, personal struggles, you know, his personal life's being splashed in the tabloids a bit, being extorted at one point, you know, over such issues. You know, he talked to the audience and addressed things in a serious way. And you can say, well, that's not what I'm turning into the late show for, David Letterman. Thanks very much. But, you know, because he was there year after year and because we understood his sensibility and because people got where he was coming from, he earned that in a certain way. And even if you disagreed with what he had to say, it was interesting to hear where he landed on such things. And that's the way in which people who, even though they're usually coming at you with punchlines and satire, can sometimes offer a greater reflection on more serious issues.
And very serious issue there from Jimmy Kimmel. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.